Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Why Bitcoin Podcast. Joined here today with not a Bitcoiner, or maybe would not describe himself as a big. I don't know what you just joined on the show today by with Bobby from Barbell Finance. Bobby, welcome to the show.
Hey, Sly. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I don't identify really, I think, as anything. I just want to pursue financial freedom, and however I get there is however I get there.
Right on, dude. Here, oh man, you know what? That's almost a fucking triggering. Feel free to swear on my show too. I gave up not swearing. That was like a triggering word for me for a while, because financial freedom is a term you hear a lot in Ponzi schemes and things of that nature. What's the other thing people love to do? Where you buy something, you sell it.
Like the MLMs,
multi-level MLM. Marketing. Thank you. Yeah. Multi-level marketing loves saying make your financial freedom. So what does financial freedom mean to you?
Yeah, it's a super personal question. I don't think there's really an objective measure, in the traditional finance space and, you know, with FIRE, financial dependents, retire early. They say, hey, once you've got, 25X your annual expenses, which is essentially a 4% withdrawal rate, you're financially free. I don't view financial freedom as like a light switch you just turn on and off. It's like, hey, I've hit a number in my portfolio. I'm financially free. And now I can just go live my financially free life, whatever that looks like. It's really for me just more of like a dimmer switch, right? If we're going to keep that same analogy. So it's like you're going to constantly kind of slide that dimmer switch and get a little more free as you go along. So, as an example, right? Someone who's got $100,000 put away, invested, saved, is a lot more financially free than someone who's, paycheck to paycheck, scraping by and one emergency away from having to take on some debt and it being catastrophic. There's all the different acronyms of financial independence as well. Like there's COSFI, FATFI, LeanFI. But really it's just, what's the life that you want to live? How can you create that life? And for a lot of people, that doesn't require $1 million. And for some it does, but yeah, it's definitely a super personal thing and there's really no one size fits all to it.
Yeah, that's a fair answer, man. I think just if you have a little bit of savings, that's where I came in. I was stressed out about money, and then you get a little savings and you're a little bit less stressed out. You have a little bit more savings and the stress levels go down with the more savings you have, so long as you understand how to control and take care of that money, right? So where did you... What first made you interested in the investing world or just the money world in general? Had you been in it your entire adult life, or when did you start getting into that space?
Yeah, I guess this is a good time maybe for a little quick background about me. So I'm 34 years old. I've been in the world of corporate finance for about 12 years. That's where my career has been. I kind of just naturally, pursued a degree in my undergraduate studies that I thought had a lot of upward potential, and that was in business. And a lot of my network was in the traditional finance world. So I kind of tapped into that. I fell into the world of financial crime compliance. So I ended up ultimately directing a team of stock fraud investigators and financial crime specialists for a very large financial institution. And then essentially after 12 years in that world, I decided to step away. I think I had enough financial freedom to say, hey, I'm done with the corporate world. And then after doing that for a few months, I realized that psychology is a lot more complex than it seems, and had a lot of hard time with just the identity and moving on from that past life and letting go of my career. So I'm actually heading back into the world of corporate finance here in a couple months. I've accepted a different opportunity. So I think that exposure to the world of just banking and brokerages, investment management, I think, naturally piqued my interest. But the funny thing about that is it's really a myth to say, hey, if someone works in finance or they've got an MBA, they're good with money, right? So I'm gonna get advice from them. From my experience, Barbell Financial is a money coaching business. I provide financial coaching primarily to Gen Z and millennials. I find that's sometimes true, but really it's not. So for me, I was 28 years old and I had what I call my financial awakening. It was, I'm approaching 30. I want to start thinking about, you know, getting more stable, right? Maybe having kids, starting a family. I want to feel very stable financially before I do these things, you know, buy a house. So I think a lot of people, as they approach the age of 30, start having a lot of this, you know, inner dialogue with themselves. And that's where the wheels start turning. And by now, at least for me, I was accruing a lot of debt just by living, you know, what was supposed to be the normal, and I put in air quotes, normal lifestyle, right? I took on a big mortgage. I was driving, you know, a couple cars. I was going on nice vacations, you know, shopping for nice clothes. And all the while, you know, my friends and family are all cheering me on, right? Hey, you know, go Bobby, he's crushing it. But, you know, again, when I reflected on all that, I was like, I'm busting my ass in the corporate world, trying to climb the ladder. I'm scaling my income and I'm doing all the right things. And I really didn't feel like I had a whole lot to show for all that input, right? There wasn't a whole lot of output other than just really a lot of debt, right? Behind the curtains, there wasn't much substance there. So I wanted to figure out how do I change this? And so that's when I started falling into just the all the books and podcasts and started consuming a lot of that. And that's where I made a change. And I tell people the biggest way you can make a change is you've got to kill your ego, right? If you got an ego about it and you've got an inflated sense of yourself and importance in the world, it's going to be really hard to get ahead with money. Morgan Housel, the author of Psychology of Money, he's got a quote that I love. And he says, your savings rate is the difference between your ego and your income. And I think that just perfectly sums up, you know, just behavioral finance, right? So that's kind of really just my origin story. What got me into, I'll say, a financial hole, and then my reasoning for wanting to climb out. And then from there, it was just, hey, how can I, you know, grow my income, grow the gap between my income and my expenses, and save and invest the difference, watch my wealth grow. And I've had a lot of fun with that process. And as you mentioned before, just a lot of that stress and anxiety around money, just, you know, it diminishes, right? And a lot of, you know, people that's a huge source of stress in their lives, or depression. It's just, it's money, right? Or maybe it's marital stress. It's money. So, you know, I didn't want that to be a compounding layer and factor in my life.
That's amazing, man. Yeah. You perfectly describe what the fiat world has people expect. You know, you get a good job, you make lots of money, and then you spend lots of money. And then you spend so much money that you need to take on debt, and then you take on debt, and then just to make yourself look rich to people that you think care. And then one day you wake up and you say, why the fuck do I own all this shit? I didn't even want it. And you're driving a nice car and you have a nice house or whatever you're doing, but you're in debt and you're stressed out and you're trying to figure out how you're going to pay it all back. It's a terrible feeling. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, whether they're either broke as fuck and can't afford the shit that they see everybody else have, or they're quote unquote rich, but they're only rich because they own a bunch of shiny toys and whatever else. And all of that is financed by debt. Can you explain exactly what it was you did in the corporate finance? Were you investing for different companies, or what exactly was your job? For somebody, like, for context, dude, I'm a construction worker. I barely know anything about the finance world. So just explain, like, I'm five, what you did or what you
do. So very simply, I worked in regulatory compliance. So the post 9/11, the regulatory landscape of the financial world got really complex. And there's a lot of rules and regulations that banks and broker dealers have to abide by. Some of those being around anti-money laundering and bank secrecy. So just think about things like sanctions, right? So Russia invades Ukraine, and now the U.S. government is going to slap sanctions on certain officials, right, in Russia, just to inhibit trade with these people and freeze up their bank accounts and assets. So there's a team of people that are, you know, that are surveilling for these transactions to make sure that their bank or broker dealer isn't transacting with these people and that money's not flowing back and forth from their accounts. That's kind of like one side of it. And then you've got another side of it, which was more my area of expertise, the bulk of my career, which we call like transaction monitoring. So basically the team that I supervised was monitoring for suspicious activity. And, you know, we had systems that would trigger for certain red flags. they'd have to do due diligence and investigations based on that, you know, that transactional activity. And we would essentially report it to the Department of Justice, FBI, you know, Securities Exchange Commission, whoever would be appropriate given the context of what we're reporting. So we couldn't really enforce anything, right? We weren't putting cuffs on people, but we would report it to the authorities who could. And then, you know, a few months later, a year later, you'd see some type of enforcement action or press release in the news to say, you know, that this person or this, you know, hedge fund was charged with securities fraud or something like that. And we knew that those were folks that we were investigating, that we reported to them, and they took the case and ran with it. You know, the best way to visualize it, I'm sure a lot of people in your audience and maybe yourself included saw the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. So that's literally what is still happening today. And that is what, you know, I was, you know, investigating and reporting. And the perfect description is the scene in Wolf of Wall Street when you've got the company, I think it was called Aerotyne or Aerodyne. And it's basically this guy in a garage at his mom's house. It's a sham operation, and they're trying to sell stock for this company, right? And then Leo DiCaprio comes in, who's, you know, Jordan Belfort, and, you know, he's got the gab, right? He can talk the talk. So he's picking up the phone and he's selling Aerotyne, but he's saying how it's going to be, you know, this next, you know, essentially like the next Elon Musk, you know, innovative endeavor. It's going to change the world and revolutionize space. And, you know, he's basically selling bullshit, right? But he's getting commissions along the whole way. But it was fraud, right? He was obviously very deceitful about the you know, financials of the business, just the business that this company was in to begin with. So that is actually very prevalent, and a lot of companies just follow the hot trend. So you know, it happened when there was the whole Ebola crisis out in Africa. You had companies that were just dormant, you know, mining companies in South America. All of a sudden, they do like a rebrand and what I'll call like a rebrand and you change their name, and all of a sudden they've got new management, and now they're in the business of, you know, hazmat suits and Ebola, you know, research, and they've got, you know, fake press releases being promoted all over, you know, forums, and then you create a buzz, and now you got people buying the stock, and then it inflates the stock price. It pumps it up, and then, you know, they control a majority of those shares. And then as the price goes up, they say, hey, this is a good price to cash out at. And they're going to dump their shares on these people. Their shares become worthless, and they get rich. So that's called the pump and dump scheme. I think you see it in crypto quite a bit, right? They call it a rug pull. Very, very similar concept. And so that's what my team was investigating and reporting. And you know, like I said, it's far more prevalent than you think. And it's, you know, something that is not unique to traditional finance or crypto.
Wow, dude, that's crazy. You're the bad guys in my eyes then, man. I'm all for people doing whatever the fuck they want with their money. Yeah, it's crazy though. The absolute insanity that people will come up with to sell shit. Yeah, what you're talking about in the Bitcoin world, we call them shit coins, where people just create some bullshit idea, sell a bunch of quote unquote tokens, and then dump them on the market when they reach a high price. It's the same thing that, yeah, I'm a big fan of The Wolf of Wall Street. It is a crazy story, right? And these are all functions of what happens when, in my opinion, when the money's broken and people are doing whatever they can to generate money for themselves, because there's so many different ways to manipulate the markets. This is one of the things Bitcoin fixes, in my opinion.
And you know what the sad thing is too, Sly, is it's always driven by greed. I should say always. A lot of times driven by greed. A lot of these folks actually had legitimate businesses. They're very smart people. They're making a lot of money, you know, fair and square, but it's just not enough for them. And they take it, and they cross a line, and they start taking advantage. You know, elder abuse is a big thing, right? They take advantage of just unsuspecting, you know, older men and women who aren't as sophisticated with, you know, phishing scams and things of that nature. You know, or it's just people, you know, who are trying to get rich quick. And the only person getting rich quick is the person perpetuating the scam.
Absolutely, man. Are you familiar with a YouTuber streamer fella named Kit Boga by any chance?
Yeah, is he the one who I guess he like exposes the scammers, right? I think like overseas. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's so he gets people to call in, and then he'll pretend he's an old lady or whatever. You'd be interested in his videos if you're into that stuff.
Yeah, I've seen a couple. Yeah, he's entertaining for sure.
It's crazy what those scammers will go to try and steal money from people. It's a real shame what's going on. Okay, let me get an idea of where you stand on What are your thoughts on Bitcoin in general?
Yeah, so again, like I said earlier, I definitely don't identify as a Bitcoiner. I own Bitcoin. I like Bitcoin. I just don't have 100% of my portfolio in Bitcoin. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, again, I mentioned earlier how personal finance is personal. I don't think it needs to be an all or nothing equation. You know, I've talked to a lot of other Bitcoiners, and they seem to get very angry when I tell them that I'm not 100% Bitcoin. But, you know, I like to be a little more diversified. I do think that what's happening with just the fiat system and the spending and the debt spiral that's kind of happening before our eyes, none of that is sustainable, right? The deficit's getting larger and larger. The cost to service that debt is getting more and more expensive. I don't see any good way that that ends. I know that the Federal Reserve will continue to kick the can down the road. They could probably kick it, you know, down a pretty far road, just given the tools that they have. So I don't know how it ends. I don't know when it ends. But, you know, in general, overall, I try not to be so like doom and gloom about it, right? I'm not like, hey, Robert Kiyosaki, like the sky's falling, the world's going to end. You know, we've enjoyed reserve currency status, you know, I think for coming up on like 80 years or something like that. And it's going to change hands, right? We're not going to enjoy reserve currency status with the US dollar forever. You know, on average, it's about every 100 years, the reserve currency has changed hands. So there's really a few different outcomes that can happen with that. It's a different, you know, nation's fiat becomes a reserve currency, which in my mind is very unlikely. That's nothing really competes with the dollar's dominance and trade dominance. We can get back to a gold standard, right? I think that's possible. You know, I don't think gold is perfect money, but I think economically things were better when we were on a gold standard. But, you know, gold really isn't portable. It's really not divisible. Or we can get onto a Bitcoin standard, which again, I think we have a much longer way to go to ever get there. But regardless of that ever happening, you know, for me, the value in Bitcoin is just, you know, you're preserving purchasing power of your dollars. We know that the US dollar is going to continue to devalue because 100% of fiat throughout centuries of history has been devalued. So, you know, I like it as a store of value. I like that it's digital, right? I like that, hey, this is where the world is heading. I like that you control it, right? It's not centralized. So yeah, there's a lot of things that I do like about it. I think I've typically been a more conservative investor. And so, you know, the volatility of Bitcoin is something that, you know, I think it's some use getting used to. So that's something that, you know, I've had to ride that roller coaster. And, you know, I first bought Bitcoin back in 2020 during, you know, lockdowns and quarantine and all that. I bought half a Bitcoin when the price was 7,500. And I remember just watching the price action. It's not like traditional finance, right? A big day in TradFi is a 2% move, right? A big day in Bitcoin, especially, you know, some years ago, could have been, you know, 10 to 15% in a day, and that was normal. But that takes, you know, some getting used to with the stomach. And I remember I sold it a few days later after I bought it. I obviously regret it now. But I think it just, you know, you have to get used to just that price action and get you and figure out what your risk tolerance is for what you want exposed to it.
That's wild, man. You should have held on to that half of Bitcoin. Hopefully you can get another one soon. Yeah, 10% movement in a day. We actually just had one of those yesterday. Lots of fun. So you say you're a conservative investor. I'd love to know, I don't know what the legalities are here. So if you're not allowed to say, that's fine. But can you tell me at least examples of what you do invest in? And then also I'd love to hear about how much research you put into the investments that you have before you buy them. And also, well, I guess those two questions to start.
Yeah, sure. I mean, so to be clear also, I'm not a licensed, you know, investment advisor. Yeah, obviously, nothing here is financial advice. So I
no financial advice.
I'll get a plug, right? But yeah, no. I'm. I know you and I connected on X. I'm very transparent on X about, you know, what I do with my money. You know, what I hold, and so I'm not a stock picker. Historically, that's a losing endeavor. You know, just no one has a crystal ball. No one knows what the next, you know, hot stock pick is going to be. You can get lucky once in a while. But the best analogy is, you know, you don't need to try and find the needle in the haystack. You can just buy the haystack when you buy a broad-based total market index fund, right? So it's just I basically own the entire global economy in two different index funds that hold, you know, several thousands of different companies. They're cap weighted, so you know, I have a tilt more heavily to the largest companies in the world. So as they perform better and better, I'm going to have more and more exposure to them. And if they start drifting, you know, and declining, I'm going to have less exposure to them. So that's kind of a, you know, a feature of the index funds. And also it's just very passive, right? I don't want to have to spend hours every single day, you know, looking at financial statements and researching different stocks and then having to worry about, you know, look what happened like just recently with like Signature Bank and all that. And like, I don't want to have to worry about, you know, insolvency and you know, then losing like 50% overnight. You know, so I've been through the great financial crisis, right? I had family that was, you know, very, you know, severely impacted by that. So, you know, I just want to be able to sleep well at night. And I don't want to spend a ton of time on my finances. Everything's automated, right? Income comes in, it automatically goes to, you know, Roth IRAs, 401ks, brokerage accounts, and it all automatically gets invested. I don't have to click any buttons. But as far as my stock exposure goes, it's all index funds, mostly US. I do have some international exposure as well. I do hold a small allocation of bonds. So mostly just US bonds and a little bit of I bonds, which I can expand on if you want me to as well. Like I said, I have a small allocation to Bitcoin. And then I have real estate. So I own my primary home. And my primary home is probably about 35% of my overall net worth.
Okay, lots to go over there then. I guess first thing I got to know, how do you hold your Bitcoin? Is it in one of the ETFs or do you actually have a wallet and understand how to hold it properly?
Yeah, so I have no desire to own the Bitcoin ETF. I'm not going to say I never will. But there's a couple of reasons there. It's number one, the fees, right? It's they charge expense ratio. So BlackRock, Fidelity's, other brokerages, they're making money. That's why, you know, I think largely they're in the business because the demand is there. And also I think they're making a killing on the fees. Just, you know, you see just, you know, all the inflows, it's they're laughing all the way to the bank, in my opinion. But you know, the second reason why I want to, you know, not own the ETF is because that kind of, in my opinion, defeats the purpose of why Bitcoin exists, right? It's to take, you know, the control of your money and have it in self-custody. So I think the only way the ETF would be attracted to somebody is if they want to hold it, you know, in a Roth IRA with Fidelity, for example, so that they can get, you know, possible tax-free growth. Like that could be attractive. I know there's some Roth IRAs that do allow you to hold Bitcoin directly, and I don't think there's too many of them, at least yet. But no, I hold Bitcoin in my own custody. I own my own keys. That's, you know, if I talk to anyone about Bitcoin, what I advocate for, you know, it does require a few extra steps, right? It's not as simple as letting Fidelity be the custodian of your assets. But you know, I'm sure you are very familiar with what happened with Voyager and Celsius and FTX and BlockFi and how many others can we name where when you kept your coins on the exchange, those weren't your coins, right? They were in their custody. They were lending it out, doing too much lending, right? They were over leveraged, had a lot of counterparty risk. And when that collapsed, you became a creditor, right? In that bankruptcy proceeding. And if you were lucky, you got back maybe like 30%. And, you know, if Bitcoin or whatever the asset you held had appreciated over that time, they locked in your cost basis at the time of, you know, the insolvency. So people took massive haircuts and lost a lot of their life savings by not being their own custodian.
Okay, that's good to hear, man. So you've done at least a little bit of research for sure to know how to hold your own keys. Good to hear.
Yep.
So what? So Bitcoiner, I guess I'm pretty skeptical. I won't speak for all Bitcoiners, but you say things like, you know, we've seen obviously BlockFi and Celsius, all these things collapse. The great financial crisis we saw, who was it? Bear Stearns or Lehman Brothers collapse?
Yep.
What helps you? You said you're a conservative investor. What helps you sleep at night knowing that any given bank could collapse at any time, whether it's, you know, even JP Morgan could collapse tomorrow. We don't know. So how do you come to terms with that? I think that's where Bitcoiners stand. again, I shouldn't talk for all Bitcoiners. That's where I stand, is like, I don't trust any banks at all. I'd rather hold all my money in case the entire fiat system collapses tomorrow. So where do you stand on thinking that the banks are going to be okay, and the fact that they are all basically insolvent, just waiting for that right domino to fall?
Yeah, so I mean, look, there's bad actors in fiat and in crypto or Bitcoin, right? It's almost always the bad actors, or it's over leverage that kind of gets you in trouble. And I know, you know, fractional reserve banking is a big concern with Bitcoiners as well. But I think my opinion on it is, you know, we've seen so many events throughout history that, you know, had we lived through, it must have been like the scariest thing in the world, and think, hey, like, this is it. Like, this is going to be the thing that completely breaks the system. And, you know, we're going to be, you know, apocalyptic here. Like, right. Think about, you know, World War One, the Great Depression, World War Two, right. You know, Vietnam. Then you've got, hey, we had inflation heating up in the late 70s, right, early 80s. The Fed chair at that time was Paul Volcker, and I think he raised interest rates all the way up to like 20% to try and reel that in, right? So, and then you go beyond that, and then you got the dot-com bubble burst, great financial crisis, COVID. So it's like, you know, what I've learned about the traditional markets is it's super resilient. And a lot of that, I think, is just because, you know, you've got a government that's going to backstop it, number one, right? You got the Federal Reserve, who can print money. They can contract the money supply. They have a lot of tools that they can use. And a lot of it is academic, which, you know, I think, you know, gets some criticism, which I think is valid and fair. But, you know, there's these tools they can use to try and help just keep a status quo. Right. And so the thing that I think is most concerning to where we're at now, and I don't know how apples to apples, you know, of a comparison it is, it's just the money supply, right? The response to COVID, to, you know, once things were kind of breaking and we saw mass fear selling off in the markets, it was, hey, we've got to start injecting a shit ton of liquidity into the economy to try and slow this down, right? And stop the bleeding and stem it off and get people out spending again, stimulate the economy. And so that capital injection, that was, you know, unprecedented. And so the money supply just went absolutely parabolic. And so, you know, you look at now even like what we went through these past few years, it's been, you know, as far as traditional finance goes, an absolute roller coaster. Look back to 2020. You've had, you know, you have had COVID, which was the fastest decline in the stock market in history, right? The fastest sell-off in history. Then you had the fastest rebound in history. And you had everyone thinking, okay, our homes are going to become worthless. The stock market's going to go to zero, right? We're all going to become, you know, broke. And the exact opposite happened, right? Then all of a sudden we go into 2021 and it's like the NFT, you know, Charizard Pokemon bubble, right? Everyone's, doesn't matter what you're putting money into, you're making a killing. So that was bizarre. And then you go into 2022, now rate hikes start happening to say, hey, like, this is like heating up way too much. And we have, you know, the fastest rate hike cycle in like 40 years. And you think, hey, like, this is for sure going to break the economy and cause a recession. And the market, stock market did react poorly to it, right? It dropped 20% in 2022. But then again, it rebounded, right? And I think we were back up like 23 or 24% in 2024. And now the stock market going into this year, hitting all-time highs. So, you know, it's a lot more resilient, I think, than people give it credit for. And, you know, I think doom and gloom and pessimism is always going to sound smarter than optimism. But from my experience, the people that stay optimistic are the people that typically make money.
That's wild, man. You know your shit a lot. I understand you're trying to be optimistic, but the way I see it, what you say is resilient, I would just say is the Fed or the government in general has two choices: inflate the money supply or inflate the money supply a little bit slower. And that's all they can really do. So when we say things like the stock market's rebounding, everything's going up again, really all we're watching is the devaluation of the dollar. You saw the real estate market go wild again. It's just the devaluation of the dollar. So that's the only thing they can do. They can make this false idea that the economy is doing well, when really all that's happening is things are going up in price, and they're going up in price because the dollar is becoming less and less valuable, which is why, you know, investors and Bitcoiners alike would say things like buy hard assets, shit that they can't print more of, because those things are going to hold their value against a depreciating dollar, which is what the government, the Fed, is trying their very best to do, is devalue the dollar to make it look like everybody's getting richer.
The biggest challenge too, I think, for a lot of people, you know, and I think a lot of Bitcoiners relate to this, is no one knows what the monetary policy is in the future with the Federal Reserve, right? Like, we don't know, hey, are they going to cut rates next month? Like no one knows what's going to happen tomorrow, let alone 10, 20, 30 years from now. But like, you know the monetary policy of Bitcoin, right? Like, that's programmed. So I see how that's attractive. I think the Federal Reserve, though, you know, it has a lot of authority. And it really has complete say in just, is the economy booming or is it busting?
Yeah, I mean, we say we don't know what's going to happen, but we know that the Federal Reserve, their goal, their mandate is to, quote unquote, stabilize prices, keep jobs at as high a rate as they can. And then their third is set inflation at 2%, which means devalue the dollar by 2%. That's their ultimate goal, is to make the money 2% shittier every year. And sometimes they do it faster and sometimes they do it slower, which makes you question, why would you want to ever hold a money that by design, in the best of cases, is getting shittier by 2% every year? Which again...
A couple of things there, Sly. So yeah, I mean, look, going back to what the old monetary system was, which was gold, right? We have a known supply of gold, and gold, you know, the supply increases by about 2% every year on average, right? So that's like a 2% inflation rate, you can call it. So that's pretty comparable. And I think that's kind of where they got this 2% kind of target from. That's my speculation. I could be wrong about that. But, you know, you asked a question like, hey, like, how do we make sure we're preserving purchasing power, you know, when we know that our dollars are going to devalue 2%? And that's why we invest, right? And at least in the TradFi world, you know, you can invest in an S&P 500 index fund. And historically, that's returned 10%, right? And it also, you know, produces income because it has dividends every year that you can also reinvest, or you can take if you need to fund a retirement or a lifestyle. So, and even right now, so like that's more of a long-term play, right? If you want to say, hey, I want to invest in something that long-term I think will outpace inflation, that's the play. In the short term, you know, we're in an environment right now, which again, things are cyclical, but the cycle we're in right now, short-term cash, whether it's in a CD or in a treasury bill or in a high-yield savings account, at least if you're going to trust the CPI number, which I think is a different, you know, rabbit hole in conversation, right? See, the CPI number is 3.1%. So you can get 5% in, again, air quotes, risk-free dollars right now, then theoretically your dollars aren't devaluing, right? You're actually outpacing the record CPI number. So that's why, you know, you don't just let money sit in a checking account with Chase earning 0.01%. That is crushing. But when you put your money to work, that is how you kind of win the game, at least in the TradFi game.
Yeah, that's fair, man. Have you ever looked at the S&P index against the rate of the monetary expansion over the last like 30 years? Have you looked at that chart?
So again, I know I mentioned that, you know, you and I connected on X. I've had every single chart and graphic thrown at me, and been called every single name you can imagine in those comments. I get it. You know, you guys are very passionate, and I respect. I have a lot of respect for anyone who is just trying to save and invest and do better financially for themselves. I just don't think like it has to be like all or nothing, one size fits all, and you're either with me or you're against me. And you know, if we're all prospering, however we're prospering, then you know that's fine.
Yeah, that's fair, man. I get it. I mean, it's fucking Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it. People get pretty wild. Bitcoiners, and traditional finance has been breaking your way into the Bitcoin realms, and my Bitcoin boys go pretty fucking hard sometimes. But it's just, you know, wild, man.
I love it, man. I have a lot of fun with it. So the whole reason I got on X is just to, I don't want to say stir the pot, but I want to trigger dialogue, right? And I want to get people thinking about things, you know, and challenging things, and I want people interacting with each other. So a lot of my posts are really meant to be posed in a way that just provokes thought, and sometimes, you know, maybe strike a nerve with some people. But like I said, my intent isn't, you know, to point out any flaws in things. It's just really to get people just, you know, having this dialogue like you and I are having right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we're all trying to do. We're just trying to understand where other people are coming from and why they're making the choices they make, why Bitcoiners are all in on Bitcoin, why TradFi people buy the stuff that you guys buy. And then obviously it's kind of, well, here's the other thing, man. Like, Bitcoiners will tell you, I guess I'll be that Bitcoiner that tells you, we've just in a strictly performance-based versus fiat gains, Bitcoin has outperformed basically any given portfolio, as it were. I don't usually use all these traditional finance words, but I'm trying my best here. But Bitcoin has outperformed all that shit every year for the last 12 years or 15 years, whatever it's been. So at what point, well, you know what, here, how about this question? What did you think about Bitcoin when it first came on your radar, and were you skeptical of it at first, and are you getting less and less because you hold it now, you understand it now? So where do you think that your allocation, as it were, will grow in Bitcoin over time, or what is your what's your future plans? Are you going to keep learning more about Bitcoin and maybe wrote, because what's going to happen, dude? Like, seriously, what's going to happen is if you have fucking 5% of your portfolio in Bitcoin, over the next year or two, it's going to become 20-25%, you know, maybe more, because it's going to go, it's just going to skyrocket in value. Like you said, Bitcoin's hyper volatile. So what will you do in that situation? Will you rebalance and buy some more index funds, or buy, yeah, what will you do in that situation?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think there's a lot of impact to unpack there. I have a lot of thoughts too. So yeah, I was definitely a little more skeptical, you know, when I first bought it back in 2020. You know, I liked the idea of it, right? That's why I was buying it, but I've definitely studied more and I've gotten more comfortable with holding it. And that's why now I can just weekly dollar cost average. And it's an amount that doesn't keep me up at night or, you know, make me nervous watching the price action. But yeah, you kind of put the words in my mouth as well. I was going to say, you know, if Bitcoin does what we all hope it to do, right? Even though I own less than you, I still want it to go up just as much as you do, right? So it may drift in my allocation, you know, to a higher percentage on its own without even having to contribute more to it. But, you know, I think between my contributions and the hope that it will do what we all think it might do, then yeah, it's going to become a larger slice of that pie. And what I'll do in that scenario is hard to answer, right? I don't know how I'm going to feel. You know, if things get to a point where in a hypothetical scenario, Bitcoin now represents a quarter of my overall, you know, net worth and portfolio, you know, I think I probably would maybe, you know, take some of that off the table and take some profits and rebalance it. But I just don't know, right? It's hard to answer a question until you're actually faced with that actual scenario. And that's also what I love about X, is you got people in the comments, you know, with such a strong opinion about a scenario that I have a hard time believing they've ever been faced with themselves. And so, but that's I digress with that. You know, so it's the kind of thing where, you know, I will keep learning about it. I do want my allocation to grow over time. And one thing I've learned in both just the traditional space and the Bitcoin space is, you know, markets are very humbling. Like, as much as we are, you know, I respect the Bitcoiners' conviction. Like, you guys have balls of steel. Like, if you held and just kept buying, you know, all the way up to the tippy top at 69,000 and all the way back down to 15,000, now all the way back up to 57,000, like, you guys deserve, you know, like, all the accolades for just having balls of steel, right? So I most people can't do it. But the reality is no one knows what's going to happen in the future. So will Bitcoin be the best performing asset going forward? I don't know. And neither do you, right? Quite frankly, has it been the best performing asset of the past 12, 13, however many years? Yes, that is a statistical fact. But there's something called recency bias, which just essentially means that just because something was, you know, the highest performer in the past is not an indication that's going to be the highest performer in the future. So if that were true, then we'd all be able to just pick stocks in the traditional world and say, hey, like, let's just look at what was the best performing stock of the past few years. Like, let's just load the boat on that, because that's going to be the best performing stock going forward. That's just not the way it works. And I know it's not a perfect apples to apples comparison, because, you know, we're comparing different asset classes. But the psychological theory is still the same and is still relevant here. So is it possible to continue to be the best performing asset going forward? Yes. Can I say that with 100% certainty, or can you? No. So, you know, I think that's just the way I view it. Would I love it to be the highest performing asset? Like I said, I own some, so great. Like we all, anyone that owns it wins.
Yeah. Anybody that owns it wins. That's a great sentence, man. It's true. Your recency bias, don't you think? I mean, that's what you do in the same time with your index funds. You're saying, okay, here's what's happened in the past 30 years. This has been a steady climb of 10% or whatever it is, 5% over X amount of years. And so you're using that same theory to buy the shit that you buy. Are you not? Wouldn't you just... So, and to be clear, I think that's a good thing to do. You look at what's worked in the past, and then you follow that trend and say, okay, well, it should work in the future, given this is what it's done in the past. Yeah, you can't be sure that that's what's going to happen. Nobody knows the future. But it's the same argument. Wouldn't you agree?
No, I think you definitely have to look back at history, right? You have to understand history to see where, you know, where have we been, to understand where we might go someday. But, you know, my only response to that is we've got quite a bit more than 12 to 13 years of performance history with the, you know, with the stock market. We've got over 100 years of data we can look at. You know, and in my opinion, right, this is solely my opinion, I think Bitcoin is still speculative, right? You're speculating that this could potentially become the reserve currency, or become, you know, this could replace the money, you know, the monetary system of the world. So you know, putting money in the S&P 500 or a stock market, like, that's not speculating if you're just a passive long-term investor who buys the whole index as someone like myself does, right? You're investing in companies that are innovating and they are producing, you know, income, right? And are productive, viable businesses. So, you know, it's hard to compare apples to apples. But, you know, I think that's really the only response I can have to the question.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's all speculating. In my opinion, you're speculating that those businesses are going to continue to provide value and that they'll keep going up in value. And you're speculating that the S&P will remain a good investment. So it's, yeah, I mean, it's hard to compare, but at the same time, it is comparative in my opinion. That's where I get people say,
yeah. Look, I mean, you know, again, going back through all the challenges that, you know, America as a country has faced economically, you know, again, like I use that word resilient again, like you really don't want to bet against America necessarily, just because, you know, historically, you know, we've been able to come back as a country. And I think that's just because, you know, again, we have dollar dominance, we have trade dominance. And again, whether you're, you know, whether it's a Canadian stock market, because I know you're in Canada, whether it's the US or, you know, Hong Kong, wherever you might be, these companies will continue to innovate, and they're going to, you know, find ways to add value to everyday lives, right? And they're going to do things, they're going to find solutions to problems. You know, and we're going to, you know, look at what Elon Musk is doing, right, with Tesla and all his different business ventures like Neuralink. These things are continuing to, you know, change the world, right? You and I are talking on, you know, microphones with computers. Like, there are companies that are building this stuff, producing it, continuing to innovate it, make it better, more efficient, more affordable. So you know, you invest in those companies and you become a shareholder. And an owner of these companies, and they share back their profits with you. And that's just the model, right? So you, again, Bitcoin doesn't do that, but again, it doesn't mean that Bitcoin doesn't have value. It's just different, right?
Yeah. I don't think, to clarify here, I don't think Bitcoiners, again, I shouldn't speak for all Bitcoiners. I'm not trying to say that I'm hoping for the demise of America or the demise of the dollar. I think what we're betting against, and you as a traditional investor, you're betting that the dollar is going to devalue. So you're measuring it against other things that have value. So you're saying, okay, I'm going to buy this company because I think it's going to be worth more dollars in the future. You can do the exact same thing with Bitcoin. You can look at a company and say, is it going to be worth more Bitcoin in the future? Or you can look at your house and say, I'm buying this house. Why are you buying the house? Well, it's either A, because you want to live in it, or B, because you think it's going to be worth more in the future. Is it going to be worth more dollars in the future? Of course it is, because the dollars keep going down in value. I do want to ask you, do you look at your home? Okay, what's my question? Are you much of a real estate investor, or just in your own dwelling that you live in? How do you feel about real estate as an investment in both the just your own single home that you live in and then versus actually buying additional real estate as investment properties?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm a proponent of only investing things you understand. And I think, you know, most people, I shouldn't say most people, let me backtrack. I think a lot of people that own real estate, whether as their primary residence or to have investment properties and rent them out, you know, that, I don't think they really know a whole lot about real estate, a lot of them. Now, it doesn't mean you need to, right? You can hire professionals to do maintenance around the house. You can hire property managers to manage tenants and all that. But if you really want to, I think, do well in real estate, I think it's really important to actually understand what you're buying. I mean, that's true for any asset, right? Like you buy Bitcoin because you understand it, right? And that makes you comfortable with it. So, but myself personally, I own my own residence, like I think we mentioned earlier. So that provides obviously shelter, right? So that's the utility there for me. And, you know, as long as I pay my property taxes, I'm always going to have a roof over my head. I have owned rental, real estate in the past. And so I had tenants and, you know, nothing about that is passive income. So as much as HGTV wants to glorify real estate and say, hey, like, this is going to how you're going to get rich. I mean, you certainly, that's certainly one path to wealth. It's just, you know, it's way more hands-on. It's way messier. You know, I was in California, you know, on a vacation. I think I was in Yosemite National Park with my wife, and, you know, we've got our tenant, you know, texting us about, you know, the ants in the kitchen, and like, it was a total buzzkill. And then I've got to contact, you know, a pest control company and deal with it. So that got old real quick. And so, but we did well with it, right? We had a great cash flow on it. We had a great tenant. But I don't know that that's something I'll do again, unless there's this amazing opportunity that I can't pass up on. And in this market, I don't know where that exists, right? I think home valuations have gone so nuts and interest rates are so high, so that your mortgage payment on that asset, you know, there's not going to be a whole lot of cushion there between what you could possibly rent it for and what what your expenses are to own it. So, you know, unless, you know, there's certain markets where you could find a killer deal, and in my market here, in the Northeast where I am, that just doesn't exist right now. But, you know, like I said, you can certainly build a lot of wealth in real estate. You can certainly scale it, get a lot of units. You can outsource a lot of it. But even when you outsource it to a property manager, say, hey, I'm going to pay somebody. You deal with the tenants. You deal with the contractors. It's still your headspace that's being occupied by it. And you still have to manage the property manager, right? It's never truly passive. But I love real estate. Like, I renovated my own house, did a lot of it myself. And I did have a lot of moments where I enjoyed being a landlord and managing my tenant. But like I said, I don't think it's for everyone. You have to have the personality for it. You have to have the patience for it. And I think that's why I have been more attracted to just, you know, long-term passive investing in index funds in the stock market, is because that's truly passive, right? Like I don't have to do anything but just keep pumping money. And like I said, it's all automatic into my index funds. I know they're going to throw off dividends every year, and they'll hopefully continue to appreciate on average 10% each year, and I don't have to do anything. And, you know, I sent a tweet out, you know, a little while back, and all it said was, you know, my index funds will never call me at 2 a.m. with a roof leak. And that tweet went nuts, but it's just true, right? Like, I don't have to like worry about losing sleep over, hey, you know, am I going to get the rent on time this month?
That's hilarious, man. I mean, that's exactly what Bitcoiners say. It's just so simple. You just buy Bitcoin, do nothing, hold it, and you watch the value go up because everything else is devaluing against it, and you don't have any headaches. I mean, you say you don't have to do anything. You still have to have... So for context, I've never invested in index funds. I've never had a stock portfolio. I never did any of that shit. I didn't even look into it because I found Bitcoin. I was like, this is the thing. And then I went pretty fucking hardcore into it. But for your situation, you still have to manage that. Or sorry, I shouldn't say what you have to do. I'm asking, what do you have to do to manage that account? How does that work? And then how do you get paid out by your dividends? What's involved in investing in those stocks? There's got to be a little bit, or what do? You just get paid and then you send money somewhere and it go, like, how does that work exactly?
Yeah. So, I mean, you open an account. It could be at, you know, Fidelity or Schwab. I'm not going to say Vanguard because I know they don't accept the Bitcoin ETF anymore. And I know the Bitcoin community rallied against them, but, you know, in general, any, you know, broker dealer, you could open an account with, whether it's, like I said, it's an IRA or just a, you know, taxable brokerage account. And yeah, you can transfer your money from your checking account or your savings account into that account. And with a few clicks of a button, you can buy, if you want to buy Apple stock, you can do that. If you want to buy index funds, you can do that. You can buy bonds, right? You can just let it sit in cash. So you can do all those things, but you can automate all this. So like they have ways to automate it where you've got auto transfers, auto investments, recurring buys, right? So all these things really make it a lot more hands-off than it needs to be. And, you know, from my experience and what a lot of the data shows is the more you try and tinker with your investments to try and time the market to say, oh, I think the market's going to decline over the next few months. I better sell out of my portfolio or vice versa. Like that actually yields worse results. So the best thing you can actually do is nothing, right? It's just keep buying and keep holding for as long as possible, right? Because the markets, you know, whether it's the stock market or Bitcoin, right? Yes, there's some up and down along the way, but over time, it's just been up and to the right. But you know, there's really not a whole lot that needs to be involved. It's just how involved do you want to be? So I like this stuff, so I probably pay attention to it a bit more maybe than the average person, but not like in a hey, I'm worried kind of way. Like I'm not looking at it and saying, oh, I want to make sure my money is still there, or I'm curious, you know, how much am I up today or down today? You know, it's more so just because I enjoy it. I like tracking it. But as far as like actually tinkering and rebalancing, I rebalance once to twice a year. I rarely even require a rebalance because there's just not such massive drift, right, in my allocation. And I'm not actively trading stocks, right? I'm not doing options, right? I'm not selling puts. So it's really passive, and that's by design, right? It's very intentional. That's the way I want it.
That's awesome, man. You should keep learning about Bitcoin. I think you'd really fucking like it, dude, because the style of investing.
I do like it, man. I like it a lot. Like I said, it's just I think I have to just get over the idea that, you know, I think what I'm trying to say is like I don't see it as risky as it once was, right? Like I think there was a time where I viewed it as super risky, super volatile. Like I actually think there's a time where I believe like this could go to zero. I don't believe that anymore. Like I think the risk of Bitcoin going to zero is essentially zero. So you're never going to be like completely, you know, out of your money unless, like I said, you kept it on an exchange that went bankrupt, right? Which is possible. So you know, I think what I'm getting at this point now in my, you know, just personal and professional life and in my net worth where I'm at this point, I'm getting more comfortable with allocating more. And I am, like I said, looking. My goal for this year is to increase my Bitcoin allocation, whether again that's through contributions or just through gains.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I mean, the more you learn about it, the more you realize it's I'm not going to say risk free, but I will say stress free. It's just you know, ease of use. You don't have to do anything. That whole idea of the options traders and the stock traders that are looking at their ups and downs day over day, I think that it's such a shitty mentality to have. You know, you're very much in the same Bitcoiner mentality of just, you know, buy something and then fucking sit back and do what you want to do with your life. Because what else are we on this earth to do other than just enjoy it, right? And so the more time you spend doing things you like to do, the better. I think that's what Bitcoin provides me. I think that's what Bitcoiners are trying to share with the world, is that if you want more time to spend doing the things you want to do, then just put your money in Bitcoin and don't worry about all the other shit, which it sounds like that's what you're saying, except you're just saying it with index funds. And so then the question becomes, well, what are you trying to maximize, right? Are you trying to maximize easiness of investing? Are you trying to maximize your purchasing power, elevating in value? What are you looking for out of your investments, as it were, or just how are you looking to save money? And I think Bitcoiners are just trying to say the easiest way to do it is Bitcoin. Also, the quickest way to get your purchasing power up is Bitcoin. Also, the way to make sure that you don't have any third party involved in your transactions is Bitcoin. Like it ticks off so many boxes that it sounds like you're looking for, man. So I'm excited for you that you're realizing that it's not something that's going to go to zero. It's good to know. And the only reason everything's going up and to the right is because the fucking dollar is going down and down and down, because that's what it's designed to do. So it doesn't matter what you fucking buy. You know, in 2021, everything went fucking wild. And that's just because they flooded the market with a fuck ton of dollars, right? And so that's probably going to happen again here in 24. We'll see. I did want to... Yeah. Sorry, I went on a bit of a rant there. I did want to come back to the house thing because you put out a tweet. Oh, forgive me if this wasn't you. But did you say you paid off your house? That was you, right?
It was me, yeah.
Okay, so explain to me why you did that. And I'll give you a little context on my question here. The thing is, with a mortgage is like the best fucking debt you can own, in my opinion. Coming from me, I don't even own my house. I'm still a renter. But if I were to own a house, you lock in a good rate, you pay it off over 30 years, you watch the dollar devalue, so the money that you're paying it off with in 30 years is so much easier to acquire than it was right now, and yet you still chose to pay off that mortgage. So why did you make that choice?
Yeah, you know, I had a lot of people chirping in my comments about, you know, how dumb that was, and this guy doesn't know what he's doing, and he doesn't understand math. You know, look, my only response to that is, of course I understand it, right? So, but finance isn't purely, you know, always going to be make decisions based on what is mathematically optimal, right? Like we're humans. There's emotions involved. We're not robots just always going to do, hey, look at the math and numbers. Like in my opinion, the psychology and emotion behind money is far more relevant than math and numbers, but obviously always consider the math and numbers. So for me specifically, I did it simply because I could. That's the simplest way to put it, right? You know, my wife and I are very fortunate to have a large household income. And, you know, for us, it was just peace of mind. And I don't want to have to be, you know, paying back a mortgage for 30 years, regardless of the interest rate, right? Still over 30, it's still quite a bit more money thrown at, you know, away at the house in interest. And you're still, you know, paying a lot more. I understand the difference between, hey, you could have arbitraged that and made a little more. But, you know, we bought our house 10 years ago and we got a great deal on it. It was a piece of shit house. It needed a lot of work, but it was in a great area. It had a lot of potential. And so, you know, we fixed it up over the course of 3 years. And so we had a lot of equity there. And then I was able to refinance it in 2020, which, you know, looking back happened to be like rock bottom rates. I refinanced it from a 30 year at 4% to a 15 year at 2.6%. And, you know, it just got to the point where it's like we had way more cash in our checking account you know, than was owed. And so, you know, when I actually ran the math, it's like, okay, like I understand like what I'm foregoing here over time, or I can just say, hey, like, I don't have to worry about like the mental gymnastics of continuing to make this payment every month, and just be done with it. So, you know, like I said, it's a very personal decision. And my response to anyone that says, you know, that was mathematically stupid, or you could have made more money just, you know, holding the cash and making the payments. My answer is you're right. You're absolutely right. But that doesn't need to be the only sole determining factor behind your decisions with money.
Yeah, man, fair enough. You got to do what you think is best for you in your life. Nah, I'm not going to judge you on it. I mean, you could have just bought a fuck ton of Bitcoin, but hey, you made the choice.
And yeah, man, look, hindsight's 2020. And if I could go back in time, I probably would have done that, right? Yeah. You know, or maybe bought like a monkey NFT in 2021. Like, you know, but yeah, we don't have, you know, we can't go back in time. And the other point I'll make is, look, as you grow your net worth and build your wealth, you get to a point where, at least for me, like my goal isn't to get as wealthy as possible. Like I have no desire to be a billionaire. Like I don't want Elon Musk's life. I read his autobiography. He sounds miserable. You know, I want to be able to provide a comfortable life for my family, and we don't have to stress about money. And the bills get paid and we've got a roof over our head and life is good. And most importantly, like you just stay healthy, because without your health, like none of this shit is fucking relevant. Right. So that's really, I think, where my priorities are. And as your net worth grows, like you do want to find a way to preserve some of that. And historically and traditionally, the way you do that, is with bonds. Right. And I know like that's probably super unattractive to a Bitcoiner. But I can see Bitcoin becoming like the new bond, especially for the younger generation. Like, I don't think Gen Z and millennials are going to be like interested in bonds. Like that's kind of like a, in my opinion, like a boomer holding, or someone like who's really in like the finance space and really understands that stuff. So I can see Bitcoin replacing, you know, bonds as like a ballast to a portfolio to smooth the ride and smooth out some volatility. Cause Bitcoin at some point is going to get, you know, a lot less volatile. But you know, I think to sum up what I'm trying to say is, like, at some point, you don't feel like you need to risk what you have for that which you don't need.
Wait, say that again. You don't need to risk what you don't have for that. Yeah, dude, that's a fucking great line. Completely.
Yeah, I'll say it again. You don't need to risk what you have for that which you don't need.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So look, if I think putting, you know, all my money into Bitcoin comes with a certain level of risk that I'm not willing to accept, and I, in my mind, it's just, hey, it's safer to do X or Y, and I think that will help preserve my wealth or you know, provide that ballast I need in my portfolio, then that's the personal choice. But like I said, I think over time, I can see Bitcoin becoming, you know, more of that role there, right? Like I said, replacing the bond or the dollar. It's just like, hey, this is where I'm going to put my money to help smooth the volatility in my portfolio from stocks and be more of that preservation of wealth.
Oh yeah, man. It's interesting, me being a Bitcoiner, listening to, or not just you, but a lot of finance people, a lot of traditional finance people are looking at it being like, oh, this is, there's something here, you know, this should be part of what we're doing. And, you know, more and more people are starting to wake up to realize that bonds are, yeah, like you said, boomer tech. You don't need that shit. It's, and Bitcoin solves a lot of problems that people are looking for. I completely agree with you. I'm not looking to become a billionaire either. I just wanted to not be stressed out all the fucking time. And I think that's what saving money, whether you're saving Bitcoin or buying index funds, whatever it is, just doing that gives you that peace of mind. Okay. Last thing, a little fun thing, which you actually opened up here for me, which appreciate. You said health, staying healthy is one of the most important things. Now you're training for an ultra marathon and a triathlon. Tell me how that's going, man.
I guess I can blame my wife, because she's the one who does all this crazy shit. She's started off as, hey, I'm going to run a 5K. Great. Fully support it. Then there's a 10K, then a half marathon, then a marathon. And then before you know it, she's doing ultra marathons, which is essentially anything longer than a 26.2 mile distance. So she's done 50 Ks. I think she did a 50 miler once. So, you know, supporting her through that and you know, being there for her and watching her achieve that, I think I got a little bit of the bug doing it. You know, I think we both have a lot of like a high achieving personalities, and you know, I think we kind of fear being mediocre or average, and so we're kind of always trying to just do things that the common person isn't doing, and we get a lot of satisfaction doing hard shit. So that's you know, what we, you know, tend to do in our personal lives, is we train for things that most people aren't doing. So we've got our first triathlon this summer. Well, my wife's actually done one. This is my first triathlon. So that will be in New York, and you know, I'm gonna have to start training for that pretty soon, and then yeah, I'm gearing up to do my first ultra marathon, and so that's gonna be 50K. I don't know the exact math on it. I think it's like 31 or 32 miles. So I've done a few full marathons before, but nothing like this. So I've got to, and that's the kind of thing, like, if you don't put the work in to train for it, it's gonna be a really shitty experience, and you're gonna be in a lot of pain.
Hell yeah, man. So what does a training day look like? How far are you going? I call myself a runner. I don't go out as nearly as often as I should, but it is what it is. But what's a standard running day look like for you? How many Ks, or how are you going for time or distance?
Yeah. So when I'm not like training for a big race, I'm in the gym every day. You know, my brand is Barbell Financial. I love two things: personal finance and fitness. I'm in the gym pretty much every single day. You know, I feel like my day isn't complete unless I've broken a sweat. So, you know, my typical day is, you know, I'll do a workout at the gym, do a lift, but you know, I try and run a mile every single day. It's just a baseline. But if I'm training for something bigger, then, you know, I'm probably committing to some type of like formal training plan, you know, put together by someone who knows a lot more about the shit than I do. And it's really just like ramping up your mileage every single week and doing it gradually in a way that you don't get injured, right? Because the last thing you want to do is like, hey, I've got this marathon coming up in 3 months and I got to go, you know, balls out for it, but then, you know, I tear my ACL, right? Or do something, you know, really damaging. It's like, you know, it's going to sideline you from that race. So you got to kind of like ease into it and ramp up. But, you know, by the time you're like in marathon mode or ultra marathon mode, it's not uncommon just to go out on a Saturday and just, you know, I'm going to go run 22 miles, you know, 21 miles. You know, you're out there for, you know, 4 hours or whatever, however long it takes you. And That's the hardest part, is just the time commitment, and then just like the physical and mental and emotional drain to do that, right? Like on a Saturday, like to wake up early, go do that, you kill half your day, and then you don't really have a whole lot of energy to do anything else after that. And then you're super sore. So, you know, the training is probably the worst part, but it all gets validated when it comes race day and you show up and you finish the race. And like, I'm not someone that like cares about my time. Like, I just want to get over the finish line and feel good about it and stay healthy and not get injured. And, but that, like that sense of accomplishment when you finally get across that finish line and know like how much went into getting to that point. It's a really rewarding, satisfying feeling.
That's awesome, man. Yeah, I'm guilty of doing that all the time. I never get out to run. So when I do get out to run, I'll just go do a random 20K and then I'll cry on the couch on Sunday. Just be like, my legs don't work now. It's not a good idea. I definitely don't recommend. So yeah, you're doing it the smart way. I appreciate that. Definitely. Let's talk quickly then about Barbell Financial. What are you offering potential clients?
Yeah. So, I mean, a lot of what I offer is free. Like my thoughts are, again, it's not advice, but just my thoughts, opinions, or views on markets, investing, whatever, you know, with finance. That's all on X at Barbell Fi, F-I. But, you know, what I, you know, offer is, you know, if someone wants to, you know, use my services, is just financial coaching. So essentially, I'm a money coach. Again, my target market and most of my clients are Gen Z and millennials. You know, these are people who are typically recent grads from college. They've got, you know, pretty good jobs or making pretty good money, but none of us are taught this shit in school, right? Like how to invest, how to save, and how to be smart, and how to do it, where to do it, you know, why to do it, any of these things. And I think a lot of people, especially in this day and age with like TikTok and social media, it's like the instant gratification generation, right? It's, we don't want to think about, you know, what a dollar could be 20 years from now. It's like, hey, I just want to like get that quick endorphin hit right now. So I think a lot of it too is just like reshaping like your attitude and beliefs about money and investing, and just educating them about that and compound interest and how that works. So again, like a lot of people when they're in that phase of life where they're starting to make pretty good money, but they never learned how to manage it. I think a lot of them end up kind of where I'm at, where it's like they have their financial awakening and they're like, I got to start paying attention to this shit and I got to figure this out. And they can either do it themselves, right? They can, you know, start reading a bunch of shit and go on YouTube and maybe find like a mentor who they look up to, who's, you know, in a position they want to be in, either with their net worth or in the business they're in. Or they can go to a financial advisor, right? Like that's the traditional route, but you know, then you're going to pay a fee. And, you know, there are some really good advisors out there who I think really are worth their dime and, who are truly fiduciaries who look out for the best interests of their clients, but still quite, you know, expensive way to do it. And most advisors, in my opinion, I think really aren't looking out for the best interests of their clients and really aren't doing the best things with their clients' money. And that's like, you know, double whammy on the fees and then the returns. Or you can, you know, go come to someone like me, who's just a money coach. So I'm not going to invest your money for you. I don't take custody of your funds. I help you though, put together a plan, because most people I think lack a plan when it comes to their finances. It's hey, I want to get to this point in my future. I want to be a millionaire, or I want to be debt free. And at some point, but there's really no plan behind that. So I think I help people just put together strategies, actual realistic plans on paper to either pay down debt, to start investing, help them set up accounts and think about, you know, what things they should be investing in, help them understand their risk tolerance and how they want to, you know, allocate their assets. So that's kind of the business I'm in. It's more just, you know, I don't want to say handholding, but it's more just, you know, educating, and just kind of being like a guiding light, as opposed to saying, hey, just give me your money. And I'm not going to talk to you again for like another 6 months.
That's fair, man. Yeah, I think that's a great thing to do. It's just there's so many people that don't know what the fuck to do when they start making money or when they're already in a massive debt trap. It can be really stressful. So to find good advice, I think, is important. So I need to ask this question then. Where does Bitcoin fall into that money advice that you're giving people? Was it non-existent? And now are you starting to talk about it a little bit more with people that you're talking to?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll answer it in two different ways. I guess the first way is Bitcoin is now, you know, for the first time becoming more accessible to like investment advisors. So, you know, if I'm a financial advisor at Fidelity, let's say, and my client wants Bitcoin exposure, well, I can do that now with an ETF, or I can even open him a crypto account, right? Fidelity has crypto accounts to buy Bitcoin directly. So, you know, you can do it either way. But that's new, right? Like that's something historically in the investment advisor and wealth management space that you couldn't ever do before, right? If you wanted Bitcoin, you gotta go figure it out on your own. So I think that's pretty cool. And as far as my clients go is I always listen to their wants and needs. So if they tell me, you know, I want Bitcoin and this is why, like, I'm not here to tell someone what to do with their money, right? Like I'm nobody's mother. What you do with your money is your business. Like I don't really care, right? You know, and what I do with my money is my business, but do I think it's going to be more prudent if you do X, Y, and Z, and this is why? Yeah, of course. But if someone tells me, "Hey, this I want to, you know, buy Bitcoin or I want to have some exposure to Bitcoin," I'm on board with that. Just what's the plan? Like, what's your plan with it? Like, is this something you're trying to trade and make a quick buck on? Is it something you want to buy and hold forever as generational wealth? Like, just what's your strategy there? Where are you going to buy it? How are you going to hold it? So I definitely help educate people with that. And a lot of times, just that conversation helps. I think very similar to what I do with my tweets, right? It's just to get people thinking about things. And so I think a lot of people get an idea in their head and they say, hey, like Bitcoin is the new shiny object. I'm going to go buy Bitcoin. And they don't really understand Bitcoin. They don't understand why they're buying Bitcoin or how they're buying it or how am I securely buying it, right? Because, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can hold Bitcoin on an exchange or a hot wallet or cold storage. So I think these are all things that people once, you know, or not until they understand, can they really have valid reasonings or strategies behind, you know, purchasing and owning Bitcoin.
That's awesome, man. Yeah. You have people that's the trouble, right? Is when we get into these massive markets where everything's going up and every asshole that's got $300 says, "Oh, I want to buy this new thing because it's going up." And you're just like, "What the fuck are you doing?" Like have a plan, understand what you're buying. We're right on the same page, dude. So I completely agree with your theory. It's all good. Look at that. Bitcoiner and regular TradFi guy, we could be friends after this. It's all
getting along just fine.
Yeah, man. I mean, we're basically saying the same thing. The only thing Bitcoiners are arguing about is saying that our purchasing power is going to go up faster than any plan you can come up with. And also, if the financial system does collapse and all the banks go broke, then anybody that has assets in those things are going to be fucked. So it is like Bitcoin is, I mean, I see how you guys can see us as doom and gloomers. I prefer the term just realists, because when you look back in history, the same story happens over and over again, right? The money fails and the people get fucked. So how can you prevent yourself from getting fucked? And that's all Bitcoiners are trying to help people with, which is sounds like the same thing you're trying to help people with. So fair enough, man. If there's any closing thoughts you wanted to say, or just feel free to show your website or anything else. I'll leave the floor open to you.
Yeah, sure. Hey, Sly, I really appreciate the time and inviting me on. I really enjoyed this conversation. I hope, you know, anyone listening to this finds value or entertainment or anything else with it. Yeah, if anyone wants to interact with me or follow me, I'm on X at Barbell Fi. So, you know, Barbell Fi. You can check me out at barbellfinancial.com. And yeah, that's it. I think I want to maybe pose one quick question to you. I think it would be helpful for anyone, you know, on my end of the spectrum who might be listening. And, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, how do we get, especially like the older generations or people that aren't as tech savvy, how do we get them familiar enough and comfortable enough with, you know, holding Bitcoin securely in their own wallet? Because it's not as simple as, hey, I'm just going to open an account, you know, with Fidelity or one of these brokers. And, you know, they just hold, you know, my money for me and they're the custodian, you know. It definitely requires, I think, I don't want to say like savviness, but, you know, you got to kind of like go through the ropes with it and get comfortable with it. I think a lot of people that turns them off.
Yeah. How does it become easier? I think it's just time, man. I mean, when Bitcoin first launched, you needed to know exactly what the fuck you were doing. You needed to have a huge string of numbers and letters written down somewhere. And then we made seed phrases and you just needed words. And before you needed to run Bitcoin Core to generate a wallet. Now there's 1,000 different apps that you can download that generate wallets and addresses that you can do. So just as time goes on, the tech's going to get better. We have a whole bunch of Bitcoiners in the space that are making it easier and easier. So, I mean, right now, it's a common Bitcoin thing to say, like, all you have to do is write down 12 words. If you can do that, you can hold Bitcoin, which is a little bit facetious, but it really does come down to that. I mean, you download a wallet called Blue Wallet, generate a wallet, send your Bitcoin there. It's only getting easier. And honestly, dude, I've heard that question before. And like me as an example, if you ask me, how do you go buy index funds? I'd be like, I don't know. That looks way too complicated. And for me, buying Bitcoin was simple. It was so easy. So just as time goes on, it's only going to get easier. If you're brand new, if you're one of Barbell's followers, go back in my shows. And I've definitely talked a lot about that. I have an episode releasing in a couple of weeks that's going to be an additional just bare bones beginning Bitcoin beginner club sort of episode. I do that every once in a while. So that's going to release in a couple of weeks. Bitcoin's only getting easier to use. That's the good news for not only Bitcoiners, but for just people in general. And then the reasons why, the problem is why is Bitcoin going up in value? Well, because you're watching the dollar collapse. And that's going to be another thing. Like right now, Bitcoiners and traditional finance investors alike are lucky, right? We get to buy shit. We get to watch our value go up, or we get to watch our purchasing power go up in value over time. But the reality is, in most of the world, in all the failing economies of the world, they're watching their value plummet because their money is being inflated, because their governments are fucked, and they're being stolen from. And in my opinion, it's only a matter of time until that happens. So people will be driven towards exits to find ways to preserve their wealth. Bitcoin's going to be there for you. Maybe index funds will be as well. I'm not sure. But it's only going to get easier. So how do we do that? Well, there is so many fucking YouTube videos, dude. There's so many books. I think, like, being a Bitcoiner, man, it's unbelievable. There's new books launching every week almost. You'll see, like, Ask a Bitcoiner. What book should I read? There's literally 32 books I could probably name off the top of my head. YouTube videos, there's, you know, a couple dozen guys that make videos that are complete walkthroughs of how to use wallets or whatever you need to know, how this works and how that works. So the education in the Bitcoin space is only growing, which is great news. And if you are the best way to do it, dude, honestly, go to Twitter, find the psycho laser-eyed psychopaths. And for the most part, this is the problem, Barbell, is that a lot of them will come off as aggressive. But if you go in, and I'd love for you to do this, man, honestly, go ask one of them genuine questions. Go ask one of us laser-eyed psychopaths, genuine questions about Bitcoin. And do it in a way that's not aggressive. You're going to get real answers. You're going to get solid answers. You're going to see that Bitcoiners are the most helpful people. I know this because this is what I did. You know, I came in 3 years ago, and you're not going to see that when you're on a big thread, but go into people's DMs and talk to people one-on-one. Find people and say, hey, can I have a conversation with you? And you're going to have a much better time than just arguing and bickering about bullshit in threads. I mean, do that on Twitter, go to DMs. So many people are open and willing and excited to help you. There's not like you said, you like talking about finance. You like talking about working out. Imagine somebody came up to you and said, hey, can you teach me how to fucking lift a barbell or teach me how to bench press? You're stoked to do it. That's how Bitcoiners feel. Like, I can't fucking wait for people to ask me about Bitcoin so I can talk about it forever. So yeah, go out, find us.
For sure. Here. Yeah, no, I definitely get that. And yeah, I mean, I think too, a lot of times because X is what it is, I think people also have a persona sometimes that they're playing, right? And so a lot of times the person behind the profile could be different. Or again, if you're just trying to maybe have genuine one-on-one conversation like we are now, it could be much more respectful and thought-provoking. You know, so I don't doubt that. I think, you know, a lot of it sometimes is just, it does come off as, you know, like attacks or, you know, and again, I don't know if that's the intention and irrational sometimes, frankly, right? Like I'll post, hey, you know, my wife and I became, you know, millionaires by 31, debt free. And the, you know, the response is, you know, this guy's not going to make it. It's like, so it's just silly stuff like that. And again, I don't argue with anyone on X. Like I find it all very fascinating and I get a lot of entertainment from it. And I just love that people care about what I'm writing about, talking about, and then, you know, they get to engage in the comments. But I think that's like some of the stuff that drives the TradFi guys. And that's again, not me particularly, but I think that's where some of like the heads butt.
It's hilarious, man. You got a house paid off, but you're not going to make it if you don't have a couple sats stacked up. So be careful out there. No, man. I mean,
yeah, go ahead. No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I mean, what is money for? It's for preparing for your future. So if you have money saved up and you have the ability to buy food, water, air, and shelter in your future, you're going to be okay. That's all we want for anybody that's looking.
And the last thing I want to say, because I know now we're kind of running over time a little bit, is just I do think there's a massive generational gap between, you know, boomers and their generation. And then you got like Gen Z, millennials, and even the younger generations. You know, the boomers didn't even have internet growing up, right? Like, think about how far that has come. And now we've got like, you know, Bitcoin. And so just think about that dichotomy between just what their experience was coming up as, you know, young adults and in the working world. Like, this stuff couldn't even be in like something they could have ever fathomed. So I do think as that generation of boomers dies off and you've got the next younger generations coming into, you know, more political offices or just running businesses or just investing with their own money. Like I can see how the adoption scale and, you know, appetite for this stuff does increase. So, you know, that's my opinion. Like I could be wrong, but I just feel like, you know, the younger generation finds the stuff more appealing, right? Like the Bitcoin is more exciting. You know, the traditional stuff is a little more boring, and sometimes people will argue, well, boring when it comes to finance is good, but I just think that there will be people that want more, you know, crypto friendly legislation, and you'll see more crypto friendly politicians, or, you know, Bitcoin. I know, you know, there's the whole conversation of Bitcoin versus crypto. I think that's something that is coming, and I think it's coming more and more, you know, in the future.
Yeah. Right on, man. Yeah. I appreciate you referring to Bitcoin as Bitcoin and crypto as crypto, as Bitcoiners. There's a major difference. You know, we didn't touch on that. Maybe I'll have you back on in a year or something. We'll see how we're doing versus each other's portfolios.
We'll see where my Bitcoin allocation is in a year.
Yeah, exactly. And but definitely it's important to let people know, if any traditional finance people are listening, there's a big difference between Bitcoin and crypto. I'll leave it at that because holy fuck, man, I've recorded like 1,200 episodes on that, so I'm not going to get into it now. But yeah, man, I appreciate you coming on. This has been a good chat. I think we have a lot more in common than people would think when we're clashing on Twitter. It's all good shit. We're all trying to do the same thing here, is just make better lives for ourselves, our families, and the people that we love and care about. I appreciate your time. Thanks for staying up so late, dude. Listeners, I appreciate you listening. Remember to, fuck, man, where are the words? Like, subscribe, comment, send a boost on Fountain if you want to do that. That'd be cool. And as always, just buy as much Bitcoin as you can before the end of the world. All right, peace.